Today, why a traffic collision involving the wife of an American spy and a 19-year-old British motorcyclist has reached the White House. And should you be changing your breakfast habits? This story begins with a traffic collision just outside the RAF Croughton Air Base, 20 miles north of Oxford. According to police reports,
a car came out of the airbase and turned right and then drove for about 400 yards down the wrong side of the road and crashed into a motorbike. The driver of the motorbike was then taken to hospital and died there. The motorcyclist was 19-year-old Harry Dunn.
Harry's parents were devastated.
We're not coping. We're literally just getting through hour to hour every day.
It was a terrible tragedy, and once the identity of the driver, an American who then left the country, was revealed, it quickly turned into an international incident.
This morning, a grieving family in the UK is at the centre of an international diplomatic incident.
It's a case that has received a personal response from the Prime Minister.
Well, I think everybody's sympathies are very much with the family of Harry Dunn, and I do not think that it can be right to use the process of diplomatic immunity for this type of purpose.
And the US President.
I was telling Boris, we have a lot of Americans that, you know, they side on the fact that, you know, you have two wonderful parents that lost their son.
From The Guardian, I'm Anushka Astana. Today in Focus, what is diplomatic immunity? And will it stop Harry Dunn's family from getting answers?
Initially, the driver of the vehicle was cooperating with the police about the accident and had given an undertaking, because she was an American, that she was not going to leave the country and would continue to cooperate.
Patrick Winter is The Guardian's diplomatic editor.
However, it then emerged that she had left, and the family, once they got to know of this, were obviously distraught and angry. And it then took a few weeks of, I think, discussions between the police and the family. And the family then decided to go public about what had happened.
Everyone asks her how she's coping. The truthful answer is that she's not. Not only has Charlotte lost her 19-year-old son, she also may never see the person responsible held to account because she's left the country.
Everyone that loved and knew him was just utterly...
And when that story broke, people were shocked. And it was a huge story, and it was a rolling story. And the big fact that was missing from that story was still, who was the woman? Who was the driver? How did we find out?
I think actually straightforward journalism. I think the police let her name be known to some correspondents who worked in the Midlands. And once her name was out, a lot of research very quickly happened as to who she was, why she'd been there. And they named her as 42-year-old Anne Sekulis, an American woman, and further research showed more about the identity of her family. She was married to a man called Jonathan Sekulis, who worked at the base.
Who were the Sekulis?
Well, they were a family from Virginia. They'd only been in the UK for 3 weeks. They had three children. He was described as a diplomat, but it later emerged that he worked probably for the CIA and in effect was a spy.
And what is RAF Croughton Air Base? It doesn't sound, from what you're saying, that it's an air base.
It isn't. There's a large number of so-called air bases which are nominally run by the RAF, but in fact are run by the Americans.
And the U.S. is set to pour more than $300 million into upgrading a military base in the U.K. It'll be used as a key part of the NSA's intelligence program.
And this is a predominantly a listening base, a sort of minor version of GCHQ, as it were.
Listening to who?
Well, they're listening to traffic coming out of Europe and the Middle East.
Anne Sekulis has been involved in a very, very tragic incident. She said she wasn't going to leave the country. What changed? Why did she leave the country?
Some aspects of this are still murky, but it's pretty clear that the US State Department and also the national security officials in America, as well as the American embassy here, came to the view that the family should claim diplomatic immunity and leave the country, and therefore no further questions would be asked about her or her husband's work. Whether that was the right decision or not, in retrospect, there's obviously quite a debate to be had, because obviously there's been more publicity about the base and about this individual than there would have been otherwise.
And reports suggest that they left with the tacit approval of the Foreign Office. Why?
Well, the Foreign Office argues that it really doesn't have any latitude in this issue, that if someone has claimed a diplomatic immunity, you can't challenge that.
Tell me about diplomatic immunity. What is it and who does it apply to?
Well, in the UK, as many as 20,000 diplomats can claim diplomatic immunity. And in essence, this is a custom and tradition that has grown out of the birth of diplomacy in the Greek and Roman period, where there was a mutual understanding that it was in everyone's interest to have emissaries going to another nation state to explain their position and to understand the position of another nation state. And they were always protected from the laws of the state to which they were visiting.
What was the motivation? Was it because there was a fear that countries would somehow maliciously target emissaries from other countries?
Well, obviously, if you can be subject to the civil and criminal law of the nation state to which you are an emissary, that prejudices your ability to do your job, because you can be coerced and threatened. And it's absolutely critical that you are free to do the job without that kind of coercion. But it's a mutual arrangement so that each country benefits from it.
Okay, so I can see that diplomatic immunity comes from Roman times, but has it been formalised more recently than that?
Yes, it has. I mean, the most recent and most full kind of bringing together of all the rules and laws around diplomatic immunity is enshrined in the Vienna Convention, passed in 1961. But you can see in there the tension, which is that it's clear that this diplomatic immunity is to help the nation state. It's not to be a benefit of the individual diplomat. It's not supposed to be a license to do whatever you want in another country.
And does it apply to just the diplomats or to all their family members?
It applies to the diplomats, their family members, and sometimes to what's described as their staff. And it can apply right across the board in terms of any kind of criminal or civil action. In reality, the history just is littered with stories of how diplomats have broken the law and thought that they were free to do so.
Do you have specific examples?
One example is a Georgian diplomat based in the US who was caught driving drunk, smashed four cars and killed a teenage girl. And it was a second drink driving offence he'd been involved in. And I think in that case, the Georgian state waived diplomatic immunity.
I understand how painful the decision to waive a diplomatic status was for President Shevardnadze. I respect my country's decision. I cannot adequately express my deepest sorrow for having been part of this horrible accident which took the life of Joan Waltrick. And
there have been other examples where it's been alleged Saudi diplomats have been raping members of their staff.
Our other focus, a Saudi diplomat who is accused of raping two Nepalese women who were employed at his residence in Gurgaon, has now left India.
A Saudi spokesman called those claims completely baseless, and there's been huge disputes about whether they can claim diplomatic immunity. You then get absurd cases like there's another example where a delegate to the United Nations, I think from Barbados, claimed diplomatic immunity for their German Shepherd dog, which had bit somebody in the park. And he said there would be possible international consequences if there was any attempt to take his dog from him.
What? Is every country signed up to the Vienna Convention?
Yes, absolutely. As long as you're a recognised nation state. We used to live in an era of empires, and so there were fewer nation states to have to be recognised in this. But now we have so many countries, and proliferating, as it were, you have more and more diplomats. I was looking up some dusty old tome on this issue of diplomatic immunity, and it showed that in the UK from 1974 to 1983, there were more than 705,000 parking tickets accumulated by what are described as immune diplomats that went unpaid.
That's outrageous.
In theory, diplomatic immunity is to protect you in the work that you are doing, but there's no requirement as a diplomat to park on a double yellow line or to overstay your slot on a parking bay. But I think once you know you can get away with it, people do it.
Okay, so clearly lots of controversial questions surrounding the issue of diplomatic immunity. And clearly, in this case, the view is that this was not part of the work that Jonathan Sokoulis was doing. But also, I'm not quite clear about whether he should have been qualifying for diplomatic immunity. I mean, you've reported that he wasn't registered as a diplomat.
Well, there is a central list which does specify the most senior ambassadorial and diplomatic roles of each country, and that's public document. And he's not on that. The Foreign Office says that is not a comprehensive list of people who have diplomatic immunity. And obviously, people who are in intelligence would not be put on that list. The additional quirk in this particular case is there is legislation protecting employees who work on foreign bases in the UK. And it's been argued by some lawyers that the immunity around people who work on foreign bases in the UK is less wide than the diplomatic immunity that stems from the Vienna Convention. And it's more specific that you can only be given immunity for something that's related to your work. And that if you got into a fight in a pub outside your work, nothing to do with your work, and injured somebody, you could then be sued.
Or if you're involved in a fatal traffic accident.
Well, again, the Americans have tended to claim that if you were driving from your work to your home address, that is covered by a diplomatic immunity. As I understand it, the Sokoulis actually were living on the base, so I don't think that would apply in this case.
Okay, so does Anne Sokoulis have diplomatic immunity?
Well, it's been claimed by the Americans. The Foreign Office seemed not to be disputing it. And so, yes.
And in the meantime, we have a situation where the parents are distraught, they're talking to the media, there is an outcry, that their constituency is represented by the business secretary, Andrea Leadsom. There is a huge amount of pressure on Anne Sokoulis, who seems to have disappeared from her home. Do we know where Anne Sokoulis is? Have journalists tracked her down? Do we know what she's saying?
No, she's been spirited away. She's not at what was their home address in Virginia, and nothing has been heard from her or her family. And the US State Department and the American Embassy here are just putting up a wall, arguing that they've considered this a very senior level and there's going to be no retreat. And this is a global policy and no exception will be made.
And does the Foreign Office agree with that?
No, I think the Foreign Office is arguing that there could be a waiver in this case and she should come back and help the police with their inquiries. I mean, the Foreign Office is always going to have to weigh how far to press this issue. I don't think the Foreign Office can do much more than plead with the Americans and say you should do the right thing.
And why are they pleading with the Americans now when they were happy for her to leave the country?
Well, I think that is the big issue, and the gap in this story is exactly how the Foreign Office behaved initially and whether, as soon as the Americans claimed diplomatic immunity, did the Foreign Office protest and how hard did they protest?
It feels to me like the thing that changed was that the family went to the media.
Harry was always one that fought for what he thought was right. We're honouring him by doing this. We just have to keep going to try and get some closure. All we need to do is to meet her. All we need to do is ask her to come back. It's not much to ask. She's left her family in complete ruin. We're broken inside and out.
But the thing that changed was that people became outraged about the case.
I think that's right. I mean, it's very hard to know otherwise. there's been no evidence produced of representations made by the Foreign Office, or what level of representation was made by the Foreign Office, whether this was something that the British and the American intelligence services agreed to sort of hush up. And actually, I think what may often happen in these cases is there's a tension between the prosecuting authorities, in this case the Northamptonshire Police, and the tension with the diplomatic service, who understand or believe there's a wider issues at stake around diplomatic immunity and relations with America.
And you're chatting to the people you know, your contacts inside the Foreign Office. Do you get a sense from that of the discussions that are going on and of the pressure that they feel under?
I think the very fact that they are eager to publicise that the Foreign Secretary has spoken to the US Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo, about this, that he's had a further meeting with the American ambassador. They are trying to show that they're putting as much moral pressure as they can.
We know that Harry's parents, Charlotte Charles and Tim Dunn, did meet the Foreign Secretary this week and came out really disappointed.
Just disgusted, let down by both governments. I can't really see the point as to why we were invited to go and see Dominic Raab. We are no further forward than when we were this time last week. Part of me is feeling like it was just a publicity stunt.
And then we had this weird spectacle of Donald Trump rambling about the issue at a press conference.
And the woman was driving on the wrong side of the road. And that can happen. You know, those are the opposite roads. That happens. I won't say it ever happened to me, but it did.
When talking about driving on the wrong side of the road and saying they would talk to Ann Sekulas.
We're going to speak to her very shortly and see if we can do something where they meet. It was an accident.
He was pictured with briefing notes saying she would not be returning to the UK and that the British had been told that. Is there anything more that could happen now to resolve this?
I think there are things that the Americans could do to try to ease the pain of the family.
Like what?
Well, I think even if she doesn't return to the UK, it would be open to the American authorities to prosecute her in America. And in the UK, Harry Dunn's family have said that they're considering taking Ann Sekulas to court in a civil case, which could challenge whether she had diplomatic immunity. And I think it's also open to Ann Sekulas to write a letter or to contact the family to explain what happened and how she left the country and the reasons why she left the country and the pain I'm sure she's going through as well about what had happened.
Because the family say they don't want her to go to jail. They simply want her to face justice.
In some of the interviews, they have very clearly said that they don't want to see her behind bars. They want to see her express remorse to them personally.
We're not a horrible family. We're a usual UK family that just need to put a face to what we have now as a name. Talk to her, find out how she's feeling. She's got to be suffering as well. You know, she's a mum.
The parents are understandably distraught about the turn this has taken. It looks like Britain is going to accept that the US won't return Ann Sekulas. Why is that?
The overall stance of the Americans is that this is a global policy and they can't set a precedent, and they won't set a precedent. There are so many other issues that the UK and America have at present, including consequences of Brexit, trade deals, the fact that the American president seems to have allowed Turkish forces into northern Syria, where the UK also has special forces. There's issues around Hong Kong. There's issues around Iran. So you always have to weigh one bilateral case in this huge maelstrom of other issues.
Patrick, thanks so much.
Thank you.
That was Patrick Winter, who is following this story. Do read his stuff on the website. Coming up, author Jonathan Safran Foer on The Way He Eats. Now, author Jonathan Safran Foer says there are a number of things you can do to help when it comes to the climate crisis. He argues that the science suggests four things that are more important than any others.
Those four things are flying less, driving less, having fewer children, and eating as few animal products as possible. So my book primarily focuses on the last. In order to meet the goals of the Paris Climate Accords, citizens of the US and UK have to reduce meat consumption by about 90% and dairy by about 60%. There isn't necessarily a problem with eating meat per se. There's a problem with 7 going on 8 billion people eating the quantities of animal products that we've grown accustomed to. Cows produce enormous amounts of methane. Animal agriculture is the number one source of methane emissions and also the number one source of nitrous oxide emissions, which are two of the most powerful greenhouse gases. Methane is 86 times as powerful as carbon. Nitrous oxide is 310 times as powerful as carbon. And by powerful, I mean the ability to trap heat against the planet. So the subtitle of my book is Saving the Planet Begins at Breakfast. And that's because the path that I've carved for myself in response to the science is to refrain from eating animal products during breakfast and lunch, and then to eat as a vegetarian for dinner. What's important is that we're all aimed in the direction of eating less. You know, until quite recently, when we've thought about meat consumption, we've thought about it as a binary. You're a vegetarian or you're a meat eater. And in the context of this climate crisis, we need a more nuanced way of approaching this subject. We need to recognize and inhabit the huge middle ground between eating indiscriminately and eating none of it. We need to eat with moderation. I have found it quite difficult to change my eating habits. A lot of the activities that climate change requires us to do less of are activities that we love. I'm a vegetarian. I've been a vegetarian since I was 9, on and off. I've had years at a time when I would eat meat. But even now, I have not lost my craving for meat. I still think it smells good and looks good and would taste good. I just try to consume as little of it as possible. You know, for years, like probably everybody listening to this, I've been aware of climate change. And like everybody listening to this, I'm not somebody who denies science. And like everybody listening to this, I care about the planet. Despite my knowledge and despite my care, I was doing very, very little. And if I'm to be honest, you know, my carbon footprint is probably larger than that of the average science denier. So the book is really a record of my wrestling with that problem. You know, why am I not acting on what I care about? Or why am I not, another way of putting it might be, why don't I believe what it is that I know? Because if I were to believe it, not just, you know, intellectually understand it, but to believe it in my heart, my conscience would be shaken and I would clearly be willing to make small sacrifices in the present to avoid cataclysmic change in the future. You know, I don't know if I'm hopeful or not hopeful. I think we want to hear people say either, frankly, either that we're doomed or that we're going to be okay, because that takes the kind of a pressure off of us to act. The truth is we're not doomed and we're not going to be okay. You know, we're experiencing this loss, and it's a process of loss which will take a century or 2 centuries or 3 centuries. And the amount of loss that we experience will be perfectly determined by the choices that we make now. So rather than contemplate, you know, the question of hopefulness, I would rather think about what it is that we can do.
That was Jonathan Safran-Foer, whose new book, We Are the Weather, Saving the Planet Begins at Breakfast, is out now. That's all for today. My thanks to Patrick Winter and Jonathan Safran-Foer. This episode was produced by Mithili Rao and Gary Marshall. Sound design was by Axel Cucutier. The executive producers are Nicole Jackson and Phil Maynard. Have a lovely weekend, and we'll be back on Monday.